You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Friday, 20 June. Japanese inflation came out earlier this morning, year on year, 3.5%. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, chatting with Kevin Whitten from Anchor. A couple of points, the Saudi update, that was nice and strong. Brait, which is really Virgin Active. And then iron ore, been under pressure so far in 2025. Sini Shipakwasami from Momentum. Geopolitics and how it could make or break South Africans' ESG future. And then thoughts from me on oil. No one knows where the price is going, but higher is probably the most likely option. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb, two-pot payouts surge to $57 billion with 4 million withdrawals. $15 billion has been collected in taxes. $15 billion, that's a 0.5% VAT increase. Business Day, Reserve Bank says uncertainty worse than during COVID-19. Geopolitical tensions, fragile infrastructure, and threat of sudden capital outflows have all intensified since the November review. Morning markets, the US was closed yesterday for Juneteenth. Over in the east, mostly red. Sydney down 0.1%, as is Tokyo. Hong Kong is up 1%, and Tencent up 0.5%. Commodities, mostly red. Gold futures, $3,385 an ounce. Brent is the green at $76.90. Platinum slipping, $1,291. And palladium, $1,048. Rand is $18.01. Bitcoin, $104,600. Top 40 opening call, 460 points to the green, or a little over 0.5% higher.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Kieran Whitten from Anchor. Kieran, always appreciate the early morning time. Let's start with that Stardew update. It was just an AGM update, so it's not the most depth in terms of numbers and the like, but it was a good set of numbers, I thought. Certainly, we've got a little bit of an education sector in the JSE, and Stardew doing well.
Good morning, Simon. Good to be on the show again. So we've obviously liked this, the education space, and Stardew has been a relative outperformer this year and actually over the last few years. It really has seen strong growth. Now it has 51,000 students, most of this distance learning, with 14% being contact, and it's trading on a 19 PE, we estimate, with earnings growth expected to be between about 20 to 25% over the next 2 years. So it's not on the cheap side. But it is a growth story in South Africa, and we do like it. As you've said, there's an education space, and we think there's structural demand with significant growth runway behind the space. Stardew in particular is a capital light structure, and they are starting to open up physical campuses now, which will add contact learning students. And I think, Simon, just for us, it does fit into our framework, of our investment criteria of a company that is able to capitalize on public sector weakness. Yeah. And there's demand that far exceeds supply in this education space. And the numbers are quite staggering with the differences between demand and supply for the available places available in the universities. So Stardew still set to benefit from this, and one that we're pretty happy with going forward still. And these numbers showing that.
Yeah, and it is. It's that public sector weakness. And we see it every January. There are, I was going to say thousands, tens of thousands more people trying to get into universities than there are spaces. And that's where Stardew steps in. Earlier in the week, we had Brait. They've got the UK business, but that is absolutely tiny. They've got Premier, which of course is listed. And then they've got Virgin Active. Your thoughts on Virgin Active? Lots of media reports that they've been closing gyms. My gym, unfortunately, not been closed, so I still need to go. Your take on Virgin Active / Brait?
Yeah, Simon, so I was listening to the CEO speak yesterday, and it's interesting because spending on gyms globally has actually been increasing since COVID. And obviously Virgin Active catching the tailwinds of this, despite what many in South Africa, I think, would feel are very high gym fees. Mm-hmm. And overall, where it fits into Brait is that Brait's their net asset value has increased for the first time in quite a while. And it is enjoying, Brait's enjoying some positive momentum now after years and years of struggles. So we have missed the recent significant rally in the share price, but it is performing well. Virgin Active obviously being the bulk of this, that's 62% of its assets. And I think Brait really, and Virgin Active really suffered during COVID, obviously. Revenue collapse, but now we've seen years and years of strong growth, and we're starting to see operating leverage come through, where our analysts estimate that 70% of the incremental revenue flows straight to the bottom line. And this saw a 45% increase in EBITDA. And I think also it's important to note that Virgin Active's not just South Africa. It's almost pretty equally between South Africa, Italy, and UK, and then some operations further east as well. So performing well, and Premier Group also performing very well. Obviously, that was listed in 2023, and they are now looking, they've announced they're looking to list Virgin Active possibly into next year as part of their value unlock strategy. So Brait's obviously trading at a discount like many of these holding companies, but looking to unlock value now.
And a quick point on the closing of gyms. I mean, lots of, you know, the media likes that story. But truthfully, it's rationalization. It actually makes sense. It's not because they're going bust. It's because, well, if a gym doesn't work, then shut it.
No, exactly. It's all about optimizing the cost structure of the company and remaining capital out where you can. So, I mean, I saw the number of gyms that closed. It wasn't significant, but it was in areas that obviously were weighing the group down. And I mean, I'm a member. I've seen how the fees have gone up. So Virgin certainly is finding other ways to drive revenue.
That's a good point on that, absolutely. And then iron ore. We came into the year, iron ore was actually looking not bad, but it's kind of been one-way traffic since then. And to be clear, the one-way traffic heading weaker.
Yeah, Simon. So I think even if we just go back a bit to the start of 2024, it was trading up at around 140, and now it's trading at in the mid-90s. And the second half of last year saw trading between 100 and 120, so on a downward trend. And this year, it's taken another leg lower, like you've said. So some of our iron ore miners really coming under pressure because of this. And I think, Simon, just quickly, three factors that are leading to the iron ore price that are keeping this downward trend. The first is definitely the weak demand from China. China is obviously the biggest global consumer, and there's still subdued demand there due to a prolonged economic downturn, and the growth in the Indian market simply not enough demand to make up for this. Second is the high global supply. There's been a surplus for quite a while, with supply outpacing demand. You've got the Australian and Brazilian miners operating at near full capacity. But I think it is important to note that BHP in particular say that there is support at around the $80 level per ton, with prices unlikely to dip below this because of a large amount of global supply, of the higher cost supply that is at this level. But there is further supply actually to come online from Guinea and also from within China. But they still note that that this floor on the price should hold. And then I think lastly, the third reason, obviously shorter term global growth concerns and market sentiment, tariffs not helping this. And then slightly longer term, environmental policies leading to lower sort of output. Steel output to reduce emissions. So I think those reasons playing against iron ore. But Simon, maybe not a bad time to start looking at those companies, given the thesis that there could be a flaw on the iron ore price. I mean, I would place weight on that.
I take a point, and I agree. I think I agree 100%. I just had pulled up the Kumba chart. Yo, it's back to sort of the pandemic levels. Not quite. They're a little bit lower down, but this has been a stock that's been under, it was $800, what, 4 years ago, now to 274. Kieran Whitten, Anchor, always appreciate the early morning time. Let your money weather the storms with Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in the Stanlib Global Select Fund, a diversified all-weather equity portfolio sub-managed by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Sinisha Pakrasamy. You find her, of course, at Momentum. Sinisha, appreciate the time as always. A great piece you put out, and I really like the one line. It talks around the world shifts from Western dominance to a new, unpredictable, multipolar world. And it's a great way of describing it. And I want to talk around some of those nuances, but focus today
on ESG. And the first question is, we've seen nationalist policies around the world in major economies sort of undermining ESG progress. Why the anti-ESG stance?
Thanks so much, Simon. Absolutely. So, you know, we are finding that more and more national policies are creeping up. So, example, what we've seen under the United States administration with Donald Trump in 2.0, or even India's Narendra Modi with their Make in India push. And often these policies tend to try and protect their own domestic industries, to protect workers, to protect gross domestic product. But that really does come at the expense of the global cooperation. So to give you another example, when Donald Trump decided to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and he made the decision to cancel about $4 billion US dollars in green climate fund pledges, that tended to weaken the global ESG efforts. So similarly, if you look at India, they've got very high tariffs on their green tech components, and that makes it extremely hard for a country like South Africa to try and access those affordable solar solutions or battery solutions. Now, these policies can also have quite a big domino effect, because they do tend to raise global costs. They also tend to disrupt global supply chains, like we're all aware of post the 2020 pandemic. And they also try to discourage the kind of international collaboration that we really got used to in a post-Bretton Woods system, and those systems that were then needed to tackle climate change. Now, for South Africa, this means that we're actually caught in a bind. So our ESG and sustainability ambitions do depend on global partnerships, but rising protectionism then makes those partnerships much, much trickier to maintain.
Yeah, I take your point on that 100%. Do we have, and I'm thinking around perhaps initiatives, the African Continental Free Trade, there's China's Belt and Way, maybe even just a more direct relationship with China. I mean, do we, as a sort of non-aligned in this sort of dispute that's happening, I don't want to call it a dispute, but in the new multipolar world, I suppose, is there options that we can leverage here?
Definitely. So, you know, South Africa is what we call the non-aligned stance can actually work out to be a real asset in this kind of multipolar world. I think it does give us a lot of flexibility so that we can engage both with the Western powers as well as the non-Western powers. And we don't end up being tied only to one specific economic or political bloc. So, for example, you know, we can tap potentially into China's Belt and Road Initiative. That is just a newer version of the old Silk Road. And I think they are investing about $1 trillion US globally. And in part and parcel of that, we can then access some of their renewable energy technology, some infrastructure funding. But at the same time, instead of just tying, you know, our wagon to the Chinese economy, we can also then strengthen ties with the European Union. And that is really a laser, you know, focus on climate action. They are trying to enable countries with funding and green tech partnerships. Now, you mentioned Africa. You know, with Africa, we've got the African Continental Free Trade Area. And this is another big opportunity for South Africa. So this will enable us to then boost intra-African trade in green technologies. It can also then reduce the reliance on having, you know, very distant or geopolitically risky partners, as we found. So by playing this multi-alignment game a bit more smartly, I do think that South Africa can position itself as more of a regional hub to have this renewable energy innovation. And that will then allow us to also start to leverage off some of our richer deposits of things like critical minerals, things like platinum or cobalt. And that can really enable us to drive more progress on sustainability.
And I like your point there around a regional hub. We could almost become the ESG player within the African continent.
100%. I think this can really be a game changer for South Africa. Of course, we need to get the full African Continental Free Trade Area initiative properly off the ground. You know, there's a massive market behind this. It goes across 54 African countries. And then that can enable us to, you know, trade green tech like solar panels or battery components. And that will then be done more easily across the continent. You know, we know that one of the sticking points for the African continent is a lack of infrastructure. And of course, we have seen China coming in a big way to lay down infrastructure in certain economies in order to get commodities from pit to port. But what's really going to change the game for Africa is to build some of these road and infrastructure networks across the continent.
What sort of role could South Africa play in advocating for global governance in terms of ESG? I mean, obviously there's the Paris Accord. We are part of the Paris Accord, but the US is no longer and some other parties also not there. What should we be sort of talking to these new partners with us and saying, this is what it should look like?
So in a multipolar world where some countries are advocating for these technologies and other countries are working against it, you know, South Africa has to play this game quite carefully. And I do believe that we need to push for a lot stronger, more inclusive multilateral frameworks, things that prioritize goals like sustainability. So that means, you know, advocating for reforms in the institutions like the United Nations, like the World Trade Organization, that will just then ensure that we've got collective climate action, more fair trade policies, more governance. And I think, for example, you know, if we had champion rules that can help us to reduce the tariffs related to green technologies, we could then make things like solar panels and batteries far more affordable globally. So we really do need to push for a bigger representation of the global south within these bodies to ensure that our priorities, things like our just energy transition, can then be heard by the globe.
Is there a risk that we antagonize large economies such as India, such as the US?
100%. And I think, you know, this is that fine game and the fine line that we play with balancing solidarity with upholding South Africa's sovereignty. And we saw that exactly playing out with the United States previously, with our case at the ICJ and a number of other issues that were related to Russia. And I think this is going to be yet another test of our true non-alignment stance in South Africa. But as I say, you know, playing this game carefully means that we are building resilience within our own economy, making sure our own fiscal house is in order, preparing ourselves for higher growth rates later on through structural reform, ensuring that we've got, you know, an independent central bank, national treasury, national prosecuting authority, ensuring that we can diversify our political and economic partnerships in order to get our resources to all parts of the globe.
So risks, but my sense is chatting to you now is that there are certainly risks. We can navigate them. And our president is a negotiator of note, but the rewards just outweigh it quite markedly.
100%. You know, if we get this wrong, the risks are indeed quite big. A big misstep could mean that we do miss out on critical funding, on technology. It could leave something like our just energy plan, you know, which is around $14 billion at the moment. It could leave that underfunded, and that would leave our economy far more exposed to global shocks. And we know that post 2008, you know, geopolitical risk factors are far higher than they've been in the past, particularly post the Second World War. We are living in a global environment of higher volatility. And so, you know, we need to do everything within our power to become more resilient, to not be as exposed to those global shocks. I think making sure that we are not over-reliant on one political or economic partner, like a China or like a European Union, could also then make sure that we are more flexible and that we're not tied to a specific agenda. You know, in the worst case scenario, we would fall behind in this global green environment that's moving in that direction, particularly with the EU and China as examples. We'd probably lose more jobs and more growth opportunities. But, you know, as you say, you know, if we get this right, the rewards can be completely transformative for society in South Africa. We could be the renewable energy hub for Africa. We could leverage our minerals and our trade agreements so that we can get better economic growth. You know, we could secure more sustainability funding. We could create more jobs in green industries. And, you know, despite that global volatility that I spoke about, we can still have a vibrant, resilient economy.
Yeah, risks, but I think the rewards are markedly bigger. And the risks that I think we're aware of and can try our best to manage, we'll leave it there. Sinshi Pakosami, Momentum, always appreciate the time.
The Standard Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Some thoughts from me around oil. Certainly the price has rallied, what, some $10, $12, $13 in the last week since Israel attacks on Iran. The short answer, no one knows where price is going, but we can kind of give it some thought and get a sense. What do we really, really know? We don't know much. We know that oil is worried and that there are really two risks, I suppose, to that oil price right now. One is that Iran is isolated, defeated, whatever the case may be, increased sanctions, and that is potentially less oil coming out of them. The second is that Straits of Hormuz, if that gets blocked off, that's about a quarter of global oil flows through there. Many would say OPEC could agree to pump more, but the problem is that Saudi Arabian oil, a lot of it flows through that strait. So that would be your big target to produce more oil. So what I think we're going to see is that even if the conflict de-escalates, even if it stops, and to be clear, President Trump last night said that he will decide in 2 weeks' time if the America will or won't attack Iran. But I think even if we do see a de-escalation, even if we see the conflict completely stopping, I think those fears are going to remain. I can't see anything right now that sends oil lower. Sure, conflict stop, we might get a couple of dollars, but I think the 70, the 80 is probably the comfort zone for now, and the risk is to the upside. That, of course, is really tough. It's inflationary. It's going to hit our petrol price. It's going to hit a global economy, which is already getting downgrades for its GDP due to the tariffs. But I think we've probably got 3 months, maybe through to the end of the year, oil higher for longer. And that's our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. What's your view on the oil price? Higher, lower, maybe, and just frankly impossible to call. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. That's it for today. We were chatting with Hannah Denobriga from Prescient yesterday, talking around the idea to change our inflation target. Currently 3 to 6%. The governor refers to 4.5. Talkers, let's make it 3%. We asked you if you thought that would serve South Africa better. Two-thirds said yes, this is the time. 20% were saying no, it's too risky. The rest were saying only if our rates don't go up. And that certainly was Hannah was saying, we've got the opportunity. We can change it without having to push rates higher. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website's in the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again Monday, de-risking Africa's renewable energy.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.